got a troubled mind. Wash it out and hang it up on a clothing line, and the sun will shine.
Hey everybody, welcome to the Science Facts and Fallacies podcast brought to you by the Genetic Literacy Project. I'm your host, Cameron English.
And I'm your co-host, Kevin Fulta, a professor who cares about science communication.
This is the weekly show where we discuss the biggest stories from the Genetic Literacy Project to keep you informed about groundbreaking developments from the worlds of science and medicine, and of course, to help you separate facts from fallacies as you read the headlines. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Cameron and Kevin here, as always. Kevin, how are you this lovely day?
Okay, I'm talking a little funny. I'm missing teeth. little accident, but everything's good. And that didn't realize I had cracked teeth that had to be removed. And so now I can't talk very well. So it's great.
Did you get in another street fight?
No, it was a piece of equipment that fell on me, and it mostly seemed like it was going to be something else. I didn't even realize I cracked anything in my mouth until after it became infected and infected all the nerves in my head. So
that's amazing. I was going to tell a stupid joke about how I got a flu vaccine and you can't even tell that there's a microchip in it, but I think you just beat me with that story.
Oh, tell me about it. So you did get the flu vaccine?
I did. And nothing happened. So
the funny part for me was I had this crazy accident on a Monday, and then on Tuesday I got the flu vaccine, and Tuesday night my head started hurting. And Wednesday, all my nerves swelled up and I had pain in my face and everything else. And I'm thinking it's the flu shot. And I'm serious because I thought, well, maybe there. And I actually looked at it, like trigeminal nerve pain and the flu shot. And it turned out to just be an infected face. But, you can really see how you start to draw correlations between different events and your physiological well-being. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, look at that. We're already jumping into the science lessons, but let's jump into our actual stories now. So first up, an activist group says that we need to regulate all 10,000 chemicals that are found in food, but two experts say that doesn't make any sense. And even if it did, it's actually not possible. Next up, are gin and tonics going extinct? It might sound like sort of a silly question, but juniper trees, which provide a key ingredient for gin, are threatened by an invasive disease. So the question is, can plant breeders save it before it's too late? And then finally, GMO pineapple is finally here. It has pink flesh, and apparently it's a little bit sweeter than a normal pineapple, but it took 15 years to develop. And so the question arises, what does this say about how our society views biotechnology? But first up, Kevin, what's going on with the story about regulating chemicals in food?
Oh, boy. Yeah, this is a real winner. And this is reported by Josh Bloom and Michael Dowerson in the American Council on Science and Health website originally, and later put in GLP. And their whole discussion is about the Environmental Defense Fund. And these are folks who don't like chemistry and other technologies. And they say that every one of the estimated 10,000 chemicals found in food should be tested and regulated. Think about that for a second. Because everything that's found in food, you know, food is made up of chemicals, right? I mean, sugar is a chemical. Starch is a chemical. Coffee contains 1,000 different chemicals, one of which is caffeine, which is amazingly toxic in high amounts. Or even, a dozen cups of coffee will kill you, they say. The basic idea is that there are all these chemistries that exist in our food, yet at very small amounts, that create the orchestra of flavors and aromas, of textures and nutrients that make food food. Yet some of the folks out there in a mad rush of chemophobia feel that these should be regulated.
One of the points they make is that if you don't consider the dose at which you're exposed to a particular chemical, it doesn't make sense to worry about it. And so to just throw a big number out there like 10,000 chemicals, it's really nonsensical. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, that's totally true. The dose makes the poison. And you can have compounds that are in just about everything that in higher doses would be toxic. And caffeine is a great example. You know, it's something that we all enjoy in coffee or whatever, and no problem, you know, in its few milligrams per cup, but would be toxic at a higher dose. But you can go through any kind of food and see that same kind of pattern that many of the flavor compounds, many of the volatiles, many of the things that make food exciting in very small doses may have some sort of toxicity if you were to consume them at high enough levels. And so it really just really separates the idea of a risk-based or hazard-based assessment versus a risk-based assessment. That, you know, a shark out in the ocean is a hazard, but if you're located in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, it's not a risk. And it's the same thing here. The small amounts that are there are a hazard if consumed in high enough amounts, but you don't have that exposure.
They also make another interesting point, and this one actually gets on my nerves, frankly, but the CNN article that they're critiquing, they point out that the author just quotes Environmental Defense Fund. They don't actually interview a toxicologist or anyone who's really qualified to correct the misinformation. And I've noticed that it tends to be on these kind of food scare stories that they do this, Kevin. Like if CNN does an article about climate change, they don't go interview someone from the Republican Party to see what they think about climate change. You know, they know that they need to go find a climatologist that understands all the data. Yet on this stuff, and this happens all the time, you know, a report comes out about pesticides in food or lead in baby food or something like that, and they seem to take at face value whatever a particular activist group says. I just don't understand why in one case they would go to a scientist, and then in this case they'd go to an organization that's mostly staffed by lawyers.
Because it's not a very exciting story if you go to the FDA and an FDA regulator says, don't worry about it. And, you know, the FDA does a very good job, and this is pointed out in the article, that the FDA is made up of toxicologists, you know, board certified scientists that do these tests and understand what products are and what they're made out of and what chemical compounds constitute safe amounts. And, you know, and that is very different from the EDF, which, as you mentioned, is mostly attorneys that are that make their living identifying chemicals they don't like and things to chase. So it's a real big difference.
Now, I don't think in the ACSH article they actually use this phrase parallel science, but I think this article is a really good example of that. And broadly, the concept describes the idea that you have activist groups that, because they don't like what the consensus on a given science topic is, they just go fund their own studies and they set up their own thresholds for food safety. And basically it gives them a science-y reason to reject what the FDA says and what independent scientists say. And so when they talk to the media or they talk to the public at some kind of a presentation or something, they have all of this data that seems scientific. Do you have any thoughts on this parallel science phenomenon?
Well, that happens all the time. EDF is a good example, but Environmental Working Group is a good example. As you mentioned, they set their own thresholds. They decide, well, we think this is toxic, so it is, without any evidence that it might be. And so when you're setting your own goalpost, it's easy to kick the ball through it because you put the goalpost exactly where you know you can kick the ball. And so they're able to create alarmism and raise funds and move their agenda because of it. And that's really kind of disingenuous because we have so many good organizations such as the FDA, such as independent science, you know, university science, academic science, that give us good answers on these and peer-reviewed articles that the websites of these organizations really are relatively irrelevant. Yet they're the ones that get the media hype. And it's really unfortunate because the losers are the public who really need better answers.
So are gin and tonics going away? I'm a little depressed if that's true.
Yeah, well, speaking of toxins in food, right? You know, ethanol is probably one of the biggest ones that we consume, and not too many better ways to consume it than in a gin and tonic. I don't know. You like gin and tonics?
I'm more of a vodka tonic guy, so I guess it's like a close cousin, right?
Yeah, I guess. I like the real cheap gin. I like the Gordons and that kind of stuff, just heavy juniper, you know. But that, so this story is a little bit alarming in a way, but, and it's interesting because there's a lot more to it than the original article talks about here. The article originally was published in Scottish Farmer by Ken Fletcher, Goodbye Gin and Tonics, and it's about an invasive fungus that threatens juniper trees. And it turns out that most of the junipers that are used to create gin are found in Scotland, and something like 70% of those junipers come from there. So there's a fungus called Phytophthora ostracedrii, or cedri, Phytophthora ostracedrii. It's spreading like wildfire in Britain and in Argentina, of all places. But in Britain, it has the unfortunate target of juniper trees. And the common juniper is infected by this soil pathogen. And it kills trees, especially when they're on wet sites. So this has been something that has been a real threat to those trees. And what's really interesting about this is that it is an invasive pathogen that has been brought in from somewhere else. And I think that just by reading the literature on this outside of the article, it appears that it came in through Wales and through other spots in England into botanical gardens and other places where trees were imported. And what's really interesting about this fungus is that it seems to be transported by human activity, or maybe animal activity. Humans are animals, I guess, but by animal or non-human, you know what I'm saying. And transported around to different locations around Britain. And then once it moves very quickly through the ground and through the soil, through rainwater, and spreads very quickly in these individual on-site locations. So it is something that's becoming highly invasive and highly problematic.
Now, there is a little bit of good news, because they say there are some trees that have, I guess, a natural resistance to this fungus. So how would they go about replicating these trees that are resistant and you know, maybe saving this tree?
Yeah, well, therein lies the problem, right? If you can identify tree genotypes or different tree genetics that are resistant to the fungus, you can now clonally propagate those trees, meaning either taking cuttings or whatever you'd have to do to grow those trees. And now you have something that should give you at least temporary resistance to that pathogen. And the problem is that it takes years. And you can imagine a juniper that, I don't know what the time is to get a juniper to full production of berries, but it's probably on the scale of, you know, years, you know, 5 years, 10 years. And so it's not an easy process to just start from square one, plant a bunch of tree seeds and see it go. It is a legitimate long-term effort. And that assumes that your resistant variety is not going to somehow become infected.
Okay, so it's a long haul if that is going to be a viable solution. I read someone on Twitter say, referencing this story, you know, if you want to get people interested in plant breeding and, you know, sort of get over this fear of genetic engineering, maybe show them a story like this, which does directly affect them. You know, if you like, if you like getting a little warm and fuzzy after having a couple of these drinks, you might not get to. I don't know what the research says on a question like this, but is there any evidence that bringing up a concern like this to people would spark their interest in something like plant breeding?
Well, I always think that hitting somebody at home is, you know, always going to be a little more persuasive, but it shows how sad it is that we're not motivated by issues of food security, such as, you know, childhood blindness throughout the continent of Africa by lack of vitamin A, but gin and tonic's going away. Hold on. You know, it just shows how our priorities are so screwed up. You know, a luxury beverage that we would have here in the West, whereas in other places, they just getting enough vitamin A to keep your vision is something that people have fought and don't find as compelling an argument to continue to push technology. But these are important stories to remind us that all the foods and beverages that we find attractive are potentially threatened by pathogens, and that we need to stay on top of it with better breeding and better technology in order to beat them back.
Yeah, and that's a good point. And maybe you know the exact statistic, but I think even in developed countries like the U.S. and Canada, farmers still lose something like 20% of their yields to disease and weeds and, you know, the various pests that they deal with. So even in places where you have the latest technology and you have farmers who are relatively wealthy compared to, you know, maybe someone in Uganda, they're still struggling with this. And so I guess the takeaway is, you know, we have lots of food now, but there's no guarantee that it's going to be that way in, you know, 15 or 20 years or, you know, however long into the future you want to look.
No, that's exactly right. And it just is the call for all tools on the table and being able to respond quickly to a new threat. And that's the most important take home of this story.
So pink pineapples, what's going on here?
Yeah, that's pretty cool, isn't it? It's been in the works for a long time, and it seems like something that may be new and exciting to most people, but to some of us, we've watched this thing go for a long time. I think they first came out with a pineapple. I think they called it rosé, and I think the patent on that probably goes back into like the early 2000s. It's just a pineapple that has more lycopene. So lycopene is the pigment in fruits and vegetables that gives tomatoes their redness, that gives watermelon, grapefruit is lycopene. Any of your, red oranges, those are all high lycopene oranges. And it's high lycopene that's converted to beta carotene by a cyclase, by an enzyme that does some work on the molecule. And that has been suppressed in the what they call the pink glow pineapple. And so that's what you're looking at here. It's just a biochemical step that's been interrupted. And instead of making the stuff that we get in carrots, the beta carotene, we accumulate the stuff that accumulates in watermelons and grapefruits.
So they started developing this in 2005, I believe. Correct me if I'm wrong. And then the FDA finally approved this in 2016. So do you have any idea why it took so long to get that approval?
I don't know, but I know it's something that they've been working on for a very long time. And they're rather sophisticated over at Del Monte in their pineapple engineering. And I don't know if it's because they were thinking that there may be some threats to pineapple or, you know, other ways that they could make it more durable, maybe be able to grow it in a more extensive range. But they have been doing genetic engineering in pineapple for a long time. And this is the first time that product has come to the market. I have no idea why it took so long.
I'm guessing, I don't know much about pineapple cultivation, but from what I read, it looks like it does take quite a long time to cultivate enough of these to actually commercialize them and sell them to the public.
Yeah, the big problem is that you start with one pineapple, and now you take that one vegetative shoot, that crown, and now you got two, and then you got four, and then you have eight. So, but it takes years to be able to grow the pineapple to be able to get those new crowns. And I'm pretty sure that's really the only way you can propagate them, unless you can do it through tissue culture faster. But I think the main problem is you just need to vegetatively propagate pineapples. You don't do it from seed. So you need to have the crowns to be able to make more. And then it takes a long time to grow a pineapple. You have to grow the plant for at least a year or two, and then it'll give you the vegetative pineapple structure.
Now, I noticed that on the website that Del Monte set up for this, nowhere do you see the word or the acronym GMO, Nowhere do you see genetically engineered or transgenic. It seems like they very carefully avoided any of this language, and I would suspect that's on purpose. Do you, and again, I know we're totally speculating here, but do you think that says something about their concern about the whole GMO controversy?
Sure. I think it says a lot about it. And I noticed the same thing. I went through their website, through all their questions, and, you know, and I didn't see anything at all about a genetic engineering event. The other thing about this is that when you change the carotenoid content, you're also changing some of the volatiles that come off it. So it has a different flavor than other pineapples. And it's supposed to be seem sweeter than other pineapples. So, you know, they didn't say much about the genetic engineering. I know I'm talking all over the place. They didn't say anything about the genetic engineering event, which is really surprising. You have to kind of go back through their old patents to be able to find out what they did.
Very interesting. Well, I don't know if I'm going to try one. I think it's like $50 per pineapple right now, or maybe it's 40. I'm not sure, but it costs a lot.
$49.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That's an expensive pineapple. I don't know that I'm up for that. I get, but you know what? You also notice that when they ship it to you, they don't ship it with a crown.
Oh, interesting.
So you don't go propagate. You know, you don't Schmeisser them. And rest in peace, Percy. You don't that you can't create your own. But they say that it's because they need all the crowns to propagate their own, which could be true.
Yeah, I think I might just buy a regular pineapple and then just put some pink food coloring on it. And then I feel like that's got to be pretty close, right? Maybe it won't taste exactly the same, but at least the experience.
I think you're right. I think you could probably get away with it. And you know, and the thing is, I'm not sure that this is going to be a real game changer in any way, either in making more food options or bringing more interest in genetic engineering. It's kind of a very strange innovation in a way. I mean, it looks super cool, but I don't know how much of a game changer this is going to be for Del Monte or for science in general.
Yeah, it sounds like it's more of a novelty than anything. It is cool, don't get me wrong, but it just changes the color. And I guess, like we talked about, a little bit sweeter, maybe juicier. Those are kind of subjective terms anyway, but whatever. So we're gonna wrap it up there. But before we go, I wanted to encourage you guys, if you're listening to this and liking the show, rate it on iTunes and Spotify. Leave us a review if you like it even more. And of course, subscribe, because that does help us get in front of more people who could benefit from the show. And also, if you're liking what we're doing here, there is a little donate button at the bottom of each episode. So if you want to contribute to the show and help us expand it and do more cool stuff, then throw a buck or $5 in there. That would also be greatly appreciated. But I'll stop asking for things now. And then, Kevin, tell us what's up with Talking Biotech.
A lot of interesting things happening at Talking Biotech. We're speaking about CRISPR and some of the ethical aspects around it, and that's going to take the next couple weeks. I have an interview with Christopher Gingell, who is a philosopher, bioethicist, who is talking about CRISPR applications. But I also do a deep dive into last week's panel that got together, expert panel in quotes, where there was like Vandana Shiva and some other folks who got together and basically bashed the technology days after it was awarded the Nobel Prize. And since they didn't have any real science on the discussion, I went ahead and added the real science to it. And so that'll be on Talking Biotech over the next couple weeks, I think. It's a rather long, drawn out discussion on their side, which makes the whole episode a lot longer. So, but a lot of discussion about gene editing.
Didn't they, at one point, someone from Non-GMO Project invite you to sit in and listen to the scientists? I thought that was kind of amusing.
No, they said, why don't you just join, listen to the conversation? And it's like, I get my science from the peer-reviewed literature rather than groups of activists sitting around having a coffee clutch. And that's really what this was. It was amazing to listen to. You had five or six people who were just deeply embroiled in their own agendas, just rambling. And I mean, it's like word salad. I mean, unbelievable. But I was glad to be able to dissect it. And all you find out is that here's a group who's been wrong for 30 years about this technology, who now is continuing to try to find fear, uncertainty, and doubt in the newest technologies. And it's really rather pathetic when you listen to it, but it's worth checking out on the podcast.
Yeah, as always, go listen to it. And round and round we go with the fear around technology. But whatever, we'll leave it there. Look us up on Twitter if you want to interact. And by the way, I should say, if you do interact with us and you have questions, we'll answer them on the show. Or if you have comments, we can address those as well. So at Cam J English, at Kevin Fulta, geneticliteracyproject.org, and we will see you next time.